the crisis or series of crises in the Middle East, there are some really interesting academics and some colleagues of mine in Israel and in the Palestinian territories who will talk about how many of the peace processes have been a convening of the liberals from both sides. Like, you've probably heard the joke, like, your heretics and our heretics, they'll get together and they'll sign a heretical deal. But for some people, and I would say growing majorities or growing towards majority in both Palestinian society and Israeli Jewish society, you have people who say, I can't agree to those borders because my deal about borders is with someone upstairs. Like, that's who gave us this land. I can't end all claims to this territory because it was given to me by God. Or my goal isn't a peace agreement that maximizes individual rights and liberties. I actually want community obligations. I don't want individual liberties. That's not what I'm about. And so what do you do with those people? Like, they don't honor international boundaries and they don't aspire for more individual rights. They're not liberals. They're not neoliberals. They're like illiberals. And people don't want them at the table because it's offensive. It's outside the norms. There won't be peace there or here unless those people are included on their terms, not on our terms, in the debate about the future.
Welcome. Maybe you are old enough to remember when we could actually sit down and have civil conversations about subjects that today have become hair triggers. I can remember when I and others who maybe voted differently or believed differently or even prayed differently could sit across from each other and have these healthy, yes, energized, but civil banter. We could potentially even walk away with a new understanding of those who thought differently about things. As you are no doubt aware, those days seem to be little more than stories and fading fables. Today, the same media that censors every word so that we have to say stupid stuff like he unalived himself is also busy on the other side pouring gasoline onto these fires of political discourse. Today, we ask, is there a way back to having courageous conversations that have us growing in compassion rather than shrinking into the density of fixed opinions? And if so, how? Welcome to the Dov Barron Show. Come for the stories, stay for the learning. I'm your host, Dov Barron. I advise high-performing leaders, organizations, how to harness their emotional source code to purposefully transform their tribe. Today on the Dov Barron Show, our guest for the next two episodes is Simon Greer. He is the master of conducting exactly the kind of courageous conversations the world is desperate for right now. Simon is a leading bridge builder, strategist, and a storyteller at the intersection of faith, politics, and social change. So he's got a few things to offer us. He's the founder of Bridging the Gap, a national initiative that trains the next generation of civic leaders to engage across differences with honesty and courage. At a time when polarization is tearing across the fabric of the United States, Simon Greer offers a powerful vision, practical tools, and how we might disagree better and live together more wisely. More on that in a moment. You're tuned into the Dov Barron Show. Each episode is the exploration of the minds of those who are shaping the world. Every episode is raw, it's unscripted, and it's a collaboration between my guests and me as we dive into the truths that few have the courage to ask. We find guests for you who are sometimes unknown to the general public, but absolute titans in their field, the kinds of people that high-profile leaders turn to when they need an edge. If you're the kind of leader who craves depth over sound bites, hit that subscribe button right now, because this is where real thinkers come to sharpen their edge. This is more than a podcast. This is a strategic olive branch offered while swallowing the hard pill of compassion. Dear listener, please turn up the volume and help me to welcome founder of Bridging the Gap and a senior advisor for One Voice United and the founder and president of Cambridge Heath Ventures, Mr. Simon Greer. Welcome, sir.
Thanks so much. Pleasure to be here.
Really looking forward to this conversation. Our previous conversation was invigorating, and I think there's a lot to learn for everybody who can maybe take on a lot of what you've got to offer. But before we do that, I sort of want to do a bit of backstory because, as I said, politically we've been polarized, and to some degree, maybe some of that was due to your past career. So is the work you're doing today an act of redemption?
In some ways, I think it is. Well, it's good to be here. Maybe I'll just take a step back. So I grew up in a left-wing Jewish family on the Upper West Side in Manhattan in New York City. And when I say left-wing Jewish family, I don't mean like a liberal family. Like, I grew up in a family where whether you're a communist or a socialist was like a relevant conversation. I went to Jewish communist summer camp. Some people don't even know there's such a thing as a Jewish communist summer camp. It was called Camp Kinderland. I think it's still around. There aren't that many Jewish communists left, but I think the camp is still there. And, you know, the camp, it did leave an indelible mark in a lot of good ways. You know, bunks in a lot of camps are named after, like, trees. There are maples and pines and sequoias. Our camp, they were named after giants of social change. Emma Lazarus, Paul Robeson, Goodman Schwerner, and Cheney. Since we're in the midst of summer, people are probably thinking, like, you know, you have Camp Olympics. It's usually blue versus gray. But our Camp Olympics, every team was named after a country in anti-colonial struggle. I was on Vietnam one year. Like, that's the culture I grew up in.
So you grew up with sort of a political ideology. You were in it. And in many ways, some might describe that as a cult mentality.
And maybe it's true about cult mentalities. It's like the water you were raised in. I was marinated in social justice. Like, that's what we did.
Right.
I actually believe that's what all Jews did. I didn't know there were other Jewish people who believed other things. I just thought, you know, being Jewish, it's kind of a prophetic tradition. Like, you believe, you risk it all to make the world a better place. That's what we're here to do.
And I think in many ways that talks to where we're going to go in this conversation, because one of the things I love to remind people of is normal isn't healthy. Normal's just whatever you grew up with, whatever you got used to. And so if you grew up in this communist Jewish camp, okay, that's what kind of in your brain as a kid, that's the way the world is. You don't think of it as any other way. And if you've been brought up in a right-wing nationalist Christian group, you kind of think that that's the way it is too, until you don't.
Yeah, 100%. I have this very vivid memory. I was a tennis player in high school, and I went to tennis camp in rural Pennsylvania. I moved into my room like everybody does at the start of the season. It's like summer session. And my roommate was a white kid, and he put a cross up over the door. And I was like, huh, interesting. So I went to the payphone. We had payphones back then, and called home. And I said to my dad, I think I just met a white Christian. He laughed. He's like, what do you mean? I don't know. I kind of thought either you were black or Jewish. Like, isn't that who we are? And he said, welcome to America. Just, I think it's to your very point. Like, I grew up in the Upper West Side in New York City in the 70s and the 80s. It was a certain ethos to the place. And you could go through my life experience thinking most people are black or Jewish. That's who we mostly encounter. And of course, that's not who the country mostly is. And other people grow up other places. They never cross paths with a Jewish person or a black person.
No. And in so many ways, that speaks so much to where we are today. One of the things you and I chatted a little bit about in our previous conversation is that how many Americans don't have passports, have not traveled. Many of them have not left their own state. I talk about tribes. And in many ways, your state is a tribe. You got your familial tribe, maybe your faith tribe, maybe your greater family tribe. But then you've got your state tribe. And if you never move out of that tribe, it's pretty easy to think that that's the way the world is. They're asking people on Hollywood Boulevard, where's Alabama?
I don't know.
It's like, you know, people in Alabama, where is New York?
I don't know.
It's the mindset that seems to me as being really, instead of broadened and opened, is being fed that your tribe is the tribe. And we're the only ones who support your tribe.
Yeah, though I want to push on this one for a minute, because I think sometimes there's a framing of this dilemma that, like, the worldly people are the ones who have transcended tribe, and they see that we're all one and we're all united. And those poor idiot tribalists are back there defending their little parochial way of life. It exudes a kind of disdain for small town life. And I think it's one of the real tragedies of the way this bridging stuff has been framed. Because for me, I don't at all aspire to one kumbaya, common good, we're all the same. If we just bridge enough, we'll all agree that all our traditions roll up into one. I think the real art of bridging or pluralism or whatever you want to call it, the real art is that people want to hold on to that small town where everyone went to the same church and They felt safe walking down the street, and everyone spoke the same language they did. But as I say it, I think, oh, they're going to already come after me. I've been on the show 8 minutes. He's a racist. He's xenophobic. But all I'm saying is it isn't by nature bad that you want to belong to your place and your people. Like, I'm Jewish. Our story isn't the disciples of Jesus. Our story is the Exodus story. That's our story. Other people can share in the story, but we brought that story to the world, and that's a great gift. Our kids should be proud of that story, and other people should benefit from the story. And so for me, the idea needs to be that you can be deeply grounded in your worldview and your convictions and your tribe, and your tribe doesn't have to compete with other tribes. It could actually collaborate with other tribes. And I think that's a step that's sometimes skipped over.
I am so glad you pushed back on that, because that is such an important point, that it's very easy to get on that high horse and, oh, I'm a traveler and I've been around the world. I've also lived in very small places. There's a wonderful sense of, in a very positive way, tribe that takes place there too. I think it's those who are playing us into the tribes that's the problem. It's not that we have a tribe. It's that we're being played into the tribe to the extent that anyone out of the tribe wants to kill us or make us wrong. And therefore, we have to hold them as an enemy. And that's just not true. And I know that that's the foundation of your work, is that it's not true. I can respect your tribe. You can respect my tribe. I don't have to give up my tribe. You don't have to give up your tribe. But let's find a way to understand each other's tribe. And maybe there's some common ground.
If we accept that I'm unlikely to vanquish your tribe from the planet or from the nation, then I'm left with some other choices I need to take. One choice could be, and I believe in this, let's call this choice bipartisanship, that your tribe and my tribe might find some things we agree on, and maybe we could work on them together. That's great. I'm all for that. This other thing we're talking about is, but what about the things where our tribes fundamentally disagree? And is there a way that we can work together on the bipartisan common ground stuff, and we can learn to honor and craft a way to live together on the stuff that's like deeply irreconcilable? And I think that's the really interesting edge. Everyone hasn't agreed they want to move forward and make progress toward oneness, right? Some people do, and that's beautiful, but other people want to hold back, stay tight and narrow and bound. And can we honor and collaborate through that boundedness rather than just doing this?
To me, that's the most interesting part of your work, because I think that most people who are reasonably open-minded would say, yeah, I'd like to find a bipartisan space, a way for us to come together. But you're talking about something way beyond that, Simon. And I think that this is really important, is there are places where we will never come together. And how do we have conversations that are more than respectful, but honoring, I guess is probably better. Honoring of that. Talk to us more about that, because I think that that's probably the most difficult thing of all. I can get that I'm an evolved human being and I'm looking for where we're bipartisan and now we can come together. We both believe in family, right? We'll come together on family. Okay. But what about this? This thing we fundamentally disagree upon. That's the work you're doing that I think is rare.
Yeah. Well, a couple of examples come to mind, maybe to bring this to life a little. So I have a friend, Elizabeth. She was a student in one of the first Bridging the Gap classes that I offered. She's evangelical. And she once said to me, Simon, you mean the world to me. And I've learned so much from you. And you do such beautiful, honorable work. And I just think it's terrific. And it kind of breaks my heart that you just won't have eternal life. That's kind of bigger than how did you vote? It's like, fundamentally think I'm going to hell and you're not. And a number of people said to me after she and I had this conversation in private, we've had it on stage and public, and people said, like, why did you need to go there? Isn't it fine that you two respect each other, have learned from each other, you work together? Why dredge that up? I guess I almost felt the opposite. Like, dredge it up, because that's her deepest held belief. And if she holds that and sees me that way and never says it, then she's kind of holding back. Now, materially speaking, it doesn't result in a public policy that makes it harder for me to live my life. But I find that it deepened our relationship to know she really cares about me. And in her worldview, I have a major problem on the horizon. And we have to be able to talk about that. I would say that's like one example. On a totally different spectrum, if you look at the crisis or series of crises in the Middle East, there are some really interesting academics and some colleagues of mine in Israel and in the Palestinian territories who will talk about how many of the peace processes have been a convening of the liberals from both sides. Like, you've probably heard the joke, like, your heretics and our heretics, they'll get together and they'll sign a heretical deal. But for some people, and I would say growing majorities or growing towards majority in both Palestinian society and Israeli Jewish society, you have people who say, I can't agree to those borders because my deal about borders is with someone upstairs. Like, that's who gave us this land. I can't end all claims to this territory because it was given to me by God. Or my goal isn't a peace agreement that maximizes individual rights and liberties. I actually want community obligations. I don't want individual liberties. That's not what I'm about. And so what do you do with those people? Like, they don't honor international boundaries and they don't aspire for more individual rights. They're not liberals. They're not neoliberals. They're like illiberals. And people don't want them at the table because it's offensive. It's outside the norms. There won't be peace there or here unless those people are included on their terms, not on our terms, in the debate about the future.
Well, I know that you have a friend who is an Egyptian whose father fought in the Egyptian-Israel war back in the day.
His uncles.
His uncles, sorry. But your uncles also fought in that war on the other side. And you two have become friends. I have friends in Israel, very good friends, who are very anti-Netanyahu. And I have others who are very, very pro what's happening with the Zionist movement. I try to hold my middle ground with it, but I find it difficult. I will fully admit that I find it difficult because I'm not pro-Zionist, but that doesn't make me an anti-Semite. To me, it's like, that's such a daft idea. And by the way, brown people from the Middle East are Semites. So let's get that out of the way. They're not Jews. They are brown people born in that area. And most of the Jews in Israel are whiteys, like me and you.
Actually, I would say about half of the Jews in Israel now are those brown Semites. Nearly half are from North Africa, Persia, the Arab world, which is in a whole other conversation. But yes, Saad Solomon and I, we met at a bridging conference, actually, that I was facilitating for corrections officers and people who are formerly incarcerated. This would be another example of not that kind of lightweight kumbaya coming together, but these two groups, they really hate each other. They're really pit against each other. If you live in prison and you work in prison, you are not friends by policy and by culture. So I was facilitating a gathering of those two constituent groups to see if they could find each other's humanity, if they could open up, be a little vulnerable with each other. Could you find not just like common ground, easy solutions, but could you find big breakthrough solutions to the criminal justice crisis in our country? And Saad is formerly incarcerated. He is one of the participants. And at the opening dinner, as we got to talking, he talked about the journey that led him to incarceration and had to do with his father becoming radicalized when his three uncles were killed fighting the Israelis in 1960. And he told the story, and I convinced myself in that moment to not say anything, like to duck. Thanks, let's have dessert. This could not go well here. And so I convinced myself as the facilitator, I should stay quiet. I didn't want to alienate someone as a professional. I didn't need to get into my personal baggage. And then it just blurted out. And I said, well, frankly, like, my uncle served in the Israeli army, and we have a picture of them capturing an Egyptian tank. And honestly, in the shadow of the Holocaust, I was proud that we could defend ourselves. I was proud that we had an army that could protect Jews. And it felt like an eternity after I said it. Maybe I held my breath. And he finally said, like, oh, well, thanks for sharing that. There's a lot there. And that night when we said goodnight, he leaned over and he whispered, Shalom. And I was like, well, who is this guy? So then on October 7th, 2023, people know what happened. Hamas attacked Israel. And one of the first people to text me was Saad. And he said, I'm just thinking about you and wanted to make sure you were okay. That led to me organizing a delegation to Israel and the Palestinian territories that next February. And he was the first person. Would you come with me on this trip? And he went. And since then, he and I have done a lot of speaking in high schools and colleges. And we've actually taught a class together at the University of North Carolina called Courageous Conversations, Israel and Palestine on Campus. And the truth is, we don't agree. We were raised in very different stories. And We are educated with different facts even. But I think we're both deeply committed to the idea that our uncles were literally at war. And could it be that our children would consider each other friends and would care about each other and look out for each other, even if we still disagree about some of the fundamental issues at play in Israel?
So you brought phenomenal examples that still seem, of course, I'm projecting here, but may seem to the listener to seem impossible. They seem like they're a good idea, maybe a story, but how do you get across that gap that isn't where's the common ground, but where's the massive diversion from each other, and how do we build a bridge across that? Seems, honestly, it seems impossible to probably most people who are listening. They're like, yeah, you know what? I am never going to be friends with a Trump supporter. I'm no longer talking to my uncle or whoever it is because he supports Trump or he supports whatever it is. Or this person's voted for Biden, and how can you possibly? They become absolutes. I'm a Christian nationalist and everybody else is going to hell. There seems to be no place to build that bridge. Talk to us about this. You call it courageous conversations. I call it impossible conversations.
Yeah, fair enough. Fair enough. So I guess I can relate to the listener who feels that way because most of my career was spent that way. Like, I think my job for many years was to convince people they were wrong about how they understood the world and that they should be more like me. Like, I joke now that I believed in social change and everyone else should change, but I didn't have to. I saw the problem. I saw this problem on this issue and this problem, and I knew the answers, right? I had a playbook and I could give you the answer, and I could demonize the person who saw it differently, the leader of that movement. I could caricature them, drive rage against them, make them an irredeemable villain. Like, I was trained to do that. I knew how to do that. And that filters into then how you understand everything, literally.
Exactly.
I'll tell you a very personal story. It wasn't an act of courage that led me to make this change. On some level, maybe it was I had nothing left to lose. So I had an important job. I was a president of a progressive foundation. I was like a somebody in progressive politics and like that whole other story, but I lost my job. And I was embarrassed. I was kind of humiliated like anyone is who has a public position then loses it. But almost instantaneously, like within days, I was actually, it's a little bit embarrassing, but I was with talking to my executive coach and he said, close your eyes. So embarrassing. Close your eyes, go deep inside. Where do you feel it? It's like, oh, in my stomach. He's like, oh, what color is it? Like green. It's like kryptonite. He's like, go inside it. What does it smell like and feel like? And he's like, and now what? Open your eyes. And I opened my eyes and it's like the golden handcuffs have been released. I don't have to play a role anymore. I can be who I want to be. And this was not a rational conclusion. It was like, it just emerged from me. And what I saw in that moment was that I'd gotten into this community organizing stuff out of the Jewish communist background that we talked about. I'd gotten into it because I believed everyday people could make history. That's where I started. And 20 years later, I had lost that dedication to the everyday person. I had become more focused on being right and winning. And when I lost my job, it's like I had to kind of reinvent myself. And so I went out and spent a lot of time with the people I had demonized, with white working class conservatives, with corporate business leaders, with ultra-Orthodox Jews, the groups who were the other to me in my progressive story. And frankly, it changed my life. Because what I had done for a long time was I had put my progressive politics as the singular lens through which I understood everything. And if you didn't share my lens, you didn't get it, right? And so I was pretty certain. And then one day that drifted aside and it was like, whoa, there's so many competing ways to understand the situation. The problems are so complex. My values haven't shifted, but how to understand these problems and how to solve them, I'm awake to the fact that it's not that simple anymore and that maybe I'm less dedicated to having the resume of someone who was a change maker and instead being drawn to actually making change. So when you say they seem like impossible conversations, I did have like a spiritual leap to want to go at it differently. I'm happy to talk more about practically how do you do it because I still have to figure out what do you do when the person is in front of you and you disagree with them. But for me, what came first was that out of having nothing left to lose professionally, the space to come at the world differently, I still had to learn how. And for some people, learning the how will come before or instead of a deeper transformation. But for me, that was the start.
And I really want to get in part two of the show. I want to talk about the how, because I think it's profoundly important, because again, most people are holding it as impossible. And what you put forward, it makes it not impossible, makes it graspable, at least with the willingness. Because willingness on its own, I always say that you can be willing, not able. You can be able, but not willing. You have to be both. But what you talked about there that I think is really important is this was 2016 when you had this awakening, right?
Yeah, a little bit before, 2014.
So now you've worked with the liberal, you've worked with the Obama stuff, and then you've got this rise of Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump and a polarizing political atmosphere. She's calling him a basket of deplorables, and he's doing what he's doing, definitely not looking for any gap, any bridge. And as you and I talked about in our previous conversation, most people in America at that time were looking for something new. They believed it was Obama because it was hope and change. And then they saw it was not going to be different with Hillary Clinton. And along comes this guy who seems to speak like they do, even though he has no background that's similar to theirs. He speaks in, quote, plain language, fifth and sixth grade language. And it appeals because it's different from the usual rhetoric. But it's during that sort of build up to that, you've gone away from politics, you've gone away from making them, the others, wrong. What I find interesting about that piece is that you just described is something I tell my clients is vastly important. And that is this, is that the greatest gift you'll ever have is going to feel like the worst thing that ever happened to you. And that is called an identity crisis. The moment your identity is threatened, it feels like all the walls go up, the shields go up, the armor comes out, and you will fight to protect an identity that might not actually be yours. It may have been given to you. You've taken it on. And then something can happen that makes it different. And what you've just described to me was like your identity got shattered. And the result of that, for most people, they tried to glue Humpty Dumpty together again. I'm better now, as opposed to saying, what else is there besides this? I have a meme that's on social media, has been there for years, and it's me holding a white card, and it says, I used to be enlightened, but I'm all right now. And it was that old identity that I had, right? And it's like, what absolute bullshit. But I had to fall off a mountain to realize that identity was bullshit. And so you talk about that in that way. The question I want to go into to end this part with is, do you think that that's what has to happen for us generally? Do we have to give up the identity we have in order to have these courageous conversations, these quote impossible conversations?
I talk a lot about what I call strong back and soft front.
Let's go there in part two of the show. I'm loving this conversation. Thank you so much. Please tell our listeners where they can find out more about you, about all the resources you have, all the work that you do.
Unfortunately, I'm not that easy to find, but I am on LinkedIn. That's the best place to find me, and you can reach out to me there. I'm happy to follow up with anyone who's interested.
Well, we'll make sure that we post the links to that, and we'll be back in just one click for more of our delicious conversation with the amazing Simon Greer. Welcome back to part two of our delicious conversation with Simon Greer. Simon is a pretty interesting guy doing some things that seem impossible. He is the founder of Bridging the Gap. He's a senior advisor to One Voice United and the founder and president of Cambridge Heath Ventures. He really is about facilitating and teaching us how to facilitate these courageous conversations with people who seem very different than us, and not just about what we have in common, but how to have conversations about the things that we fundamentally differ on without having to try to convert or convince somebody that they're wrong. He comes from the world of politics and political advising on campaigns to moving from that being very much strongly on the left to going out into conservative areas of the United States and having conversations with gun owners and hard conservatives and finding that these are beautiful people who maybe just look at the world a little bit different. And we ended the last part of the conversation by talking about identity crisis, that sometimes the worst thing that can happen to you is you have an identity crisis, but oftentimes it's the best thing because you stop being so rigid about, and this is only true for me, but I stopped being so rigid about the way that I saw things were, and I had to open up a little bit and realize that there were other ways of seeing the very same thing. And where we finished was Simon was talking about something called having a strong back and a soft front. Tell us more about that.
Yeah, so it's good to be back. The interesting question about in this identity crisis is, am I saying that to have courageous conversations, you need to shatter everything you believe in and give up on who you are and step out of your mold? I don't think that. I think in a way, almost the opposite. We have to get more crisp. It's what I refer to as strong back. What do I really believe? What do I really stand for? Who am I? Not what are all the trappings of me? Not what's on my business card or what do I want to look like in public? Those things make us kind of rigid, I would say. We protect those surface identities. The more we're clear deep down about our deepest values, the thing we hold closest to us, the deepest hopes and dreams we have for the future, strong back, then we can be lighter on the front. I do some boxing, and what I realize is when the back is shaky, like you jab really quick, because you're afraid you're going to get hit. But when you're confident in your stance and you know where you stand, then you can be really gracious and open-handed and say to people, you see it pretty differently than I do. Can you tell me more about that? Rather than, yikes, that threatens who I am. Can I land a punch real quick? And so for me, a part of the Courageous Conversations ethos, if you will, is cultivating this strong back, soft front. How do I develop confidence and conviction in who I am and where I stand, and then express more of an open-hearted, open-minded front that invites people in, which doesn't require an identity crisis. Maybe it's an identity or purpose clarification. Those trappings aren't who I am. That's a story about who I am. Who I am is in here.
We cling to being somebody, that label, that thing on LinkedIn or whatever the heck it is that we cling to, whether it's faith or a position. And I find that very often people have never really asked those deep questions you're talking about, Simon, which is, who are you when it's stripped away? One of my favorite questions to ask people is, and this is not to be provocative, it's just to show them a demonstration. And I'll say, what is your faith? And they'll say, I'm Jewish or I'm Christian. And I go, okay, why? And they go, my mother's Jewish, so I'm Jewish. Yeah, what's that going to do with it? There's rumors that Adolf Hitler's mother was Jewish. I don't know if she was, but I read those rumors. Does that mean he was a good Jew? No. Does it mean he believed in Judaism? No. So you say you're a Christian, you go to church on Sunday. Well, if you park a Ferrari in a Ford garage, does it make it a Ford? And vice versa. No, of course not. So why? Asking those deeper questions of something, that in itself takes courage. You know, talking about these courageous conversations, but it seems to me that that first courageous conversation is a personal one. It's one I have with myself in my journal or with my therapist or however it is. Talk to us about getting people to that part, because I don't think you can get to the other bits unless you have that bit.
Well, what I want to say is that I think one path into this courageous conversation stuff is the deeper reckoning. Like, who am I really? And what do I stand for? How do I want to show up in the world? I remember a decade ago, I had this very public conflict with Glenn Beck when he was a Fox News personality. And then 10 years later, he and I had dinner together. And he asked me, there's a short film about it anyway. He asked me, how would I know if this meal was successful? And I said, look, I can't control what you do. All I can do is that if there was a videotape played back of this interaction and my kids watched it, would my kids say, Dad was really good tonight? Like, he didn't get rolled by that guy and he didn't have to punch him out or knock him out. He was steady and he held his own. And I thought, that's how I want to show up in the world. So one path is clarifying who I am, my purpose, the deepest reckoning. And I think that's valuable. There's a second path, we touched on it briefly, which is more about strategy. I haven't done all this reckoning, but there's 80 million people who vote the other way. And we have some serious problems in our country. Do you think you are going to beat them into submission and they're suddenly going to just vote for your solutions? Unlikely. Look at the last three election cycles. That's not going to happen. So you may not be ready to strip away the outer exterior of who your identity is and go so deep. But just for strategic reasons, decide, I'm going to take those people seriously because I got to share this country with them. Maybe this third path is that it's not about how do you solve problems with the 80 million? Maybe you believe that you're starting to glimpse that every simple solution I had, it may not solve the problem. I was in philanthropy when the answer to the climate crisis was carbon credits. That was the only solution. I think philanthropy spent $1 billion to promote trading carbon credits. It was wrong. That doesn't mean we don't have a climate crisis, but the orthodoxy that that was the only answer was an error. So could we admit that the climate crisis is complex, its causes and its solutions? So maybe listen to people you disagree with because of that complexity. You need some additional inputs. And then I would say to some people, fourth path, maybe you don't buy any of this. Look, I'm a meditator, okay? I've been meditating for a long time. Some days I think this is pathetic. Like I just sit here running stories in my head. I'm supposed to be at peace. I'm just like making a to-do list. But over 20 years, 25, 30 years of meditating, it has changed the pathways in my brain. And so you could not be on the spiritual question your identity path. You could not be on the strategic path. You could not be on the tactical path. You're just thinking, all right, I'm going to try for this Thanksgiving dinner with my Uncle Bob, who voted differently. I'm just going to try to remember that I love him. And I'm going to listen to what he says. And instead of arguing with him, I'm going to be curious about why he thinks the way he thinks. And my value proposition, that if you do that as a regular practice, kind of fake it till you make it, you don't have to believe all that stuff. But if you practice that other way, not the bam, I got your back. Oh, I've got a better fact for you. Oh, I outmaneuvered you. But just, I sat there face to face. I took you seriously. I listened with curiosity. And I asked you to go a little deeper. That opens unbelievable pathways to a whole other way of relating, and that these courageous conversations become very simple.
Now, let's go to the skills piece of this, because I think it's important. Maybe it's my cynicism, but I doubt people's courage to ask the difficult questions of themselves. But that doesn't mean that they're bad people. It means oftentimes they have their own fears, and I understand that. But they actually do want to have those conversations. They want to find a way to bring Uncle Bob back into the fold, or whatever it is, find a way to have Thanksgiving dinner or whatever it is without wanting to kill each other. I know you've got 5 specific skills that go into this. Walk us through those so that people can go, all right, I could do that, or at least a little bit of that.
Sure. So the 5 skills are purpose, listening, storytelling, feedback, and power. I think for today's conversation, let's focus on listening and storytelling. I think they're foundational and they're probably the easiest to like jump in and try. And then I'll be even more specific. So on the listening, which I think is the first step, if we skip over listening, I'm not sure we can make much headway on any of the more complex. Most humans, most days, don't feel terribly well listened. Many of us have the experience. I start to tell my story. I'm halfway through it. I'll give you an example. You've probably had this happen to you. So I could tell a loving member of my family, hey, I flew to Boston. And what I'm hoping they'll say is, what did you go to Boston for? And instead they're like, oh yeah, Boston, I've been there. Did I tell you about my trip to Boston? And that's not even so bad. The worst is like, oh, you flew there? I've flown on a plane. Have I told you about my plane flight? Now we're talking about you in London. So that's the norm. I think that's the first thing we need to disrupt. You start telling me your story and I turn on my, I'm going to be interested, not interesting. Step one, I'm now interested in you. So how do I do that? I try to keep breathing, stay present, stay focused. I keep trying to clear my mind out. Oh, Dove said something. It's interesting. I want to take it my way. No, no, no. His story, his time, I'm staying with him. And one of the best techniques for that is what I call open-ended questions. It's not rocket science. You tell me something, whether I'm really attracted to it or I feel aversion to it, I go to an open-ended question, which is simply a question that can't be responded to with a yes or a no. My favorite one is, tell me more about that. And it works in almost any situation. Tell me more about that. What was that like for you? How did you come to see it that way? What makes that so important? Questions like that. So mostly people say things expecting me to take it on a tangent, my tangent, or to counterpunch. If instead I drop down, you've given me the headline, I want the backstory. And so my open-ended questions invite you to the backstory. So now when you've said, I'm pro this or I'm anti that, instead of me giving you why you're wrong, I want to know how you got there. What's the narrative that leads you there? Why is this so important to you? Maybe it's what your dad taught you at the dinner table. That's why you're holding on to it. No fact is going to move you from that. This is family tradition. This is folklore. This is narrative. So if I can invite you to go deeper, well, one, I think you're honored is how you feel. Like, wow, I thought he was going to fight me on it. Instead, he was curious. Two, if it's something hard for me, it gives me time to breathe, regulate. And then three, I can really understand what we disagree about. Not the headline, the underlying thing that we disagree about. So if people got nothing else out of this, I would say the art of the open-ended question to go from a combative posture to a deepening trust-building posture is maybe the most foundational. And if you wanted to really boil it down, just try tonight when someone comes home and gives you a strong opinion just to say, well, can you tell me a little more about that? Just that alone can take you down a new pathway.
And it's important to realize that you, I, we, and I do not exclude myself from this, are going to not go to the open-ended question if we feel like we're going to be attacked. And that doesn't mean that they are attacking us. It means that we've set that up. My wife can say something to me and I'm in a certain space and I'm going to read that as an attack, and it's not an attack at all. She's just saying something. Because of my own defensive bullshit, I'm going to get that in the way. And that open-ended question is a way for you to pause your own thinking, which I think is really vitally important. And the one thing I would add to that with the open-ended question, may I? And that's this. You seem to me to be a person who's thought a lot about this. Could you tell me more about why you believed it? Now I'm not only asking you to tell me more, and you can maybe think, oh, he's just looking for a loophole. But if I say, you seem to be somebody who's really thought a lot about this, I'm acknowledging that you're not a dumbass who just splurts stuff, that you've actually thought. That puts your neurosystem, your brain, into a way of saying, how did I come up with this? I'm asking you actually to go through it for yourself. And that gives you room to go, you know, well, my dad always said, and then you get to think, well, is it me or is that my dad? Or, well, and then you throw an opposite and I can go, well, yeah, that's the opposite, but what made you think about it?
Yeah, I love that addition. In a way, it's a reflection. For me, one of these first principles in the Courageous Conversations is I like to say that we're going to take seriously the things that others hold dear. If it matters to you, it'll matter to me. That doesn't mean I'm going to agree with you.
No.
But it means that I'm taking it seriously. And that's what your line, you seem like you've thought this through, it means I'm not saying, you ignorant moron. I'm saying, no, wow, you're a serious person. I see this so often with corrections officers. There's all this talk about changing our criminal justice system, and no one really asks them what they think, but they work there every day, sometimes 16 hours a day. Like, they know more about it than anybody, but they don't feel like anyone has ever said, you seem like a thoughtful person. You're serious. I want to change the system. You should be my consultant, not my villain in the story, but my consultant in change. And that, honestly, it cuts people open.
What you're doing is you're elevating. And I think a lot of this othering that we do is demeaning people. We're making them smaller. I'm bigger than you. I'm better than you. I'm smarter than you. That's what those conversations are that put people into defense. But when I honor them, I elevate them. When I say, you must have thought a lot about this, I'd really like to understand that. I'm not saying I agree or disagree. I just want to understand that. Tell me more about that. As you said, they feel validated as a human being.
I often quote this 14th century Persian poet Hafez, who said something along the lines of, I treat everybody as if they're my most revered teacher speaking to me their cherished last words. And that's a tall order. Like, I then joke with people, have you ever been in a staff meeting where someone talked and you're like, oh, he's going on about that again? And of course, we all do that. Hafez is saying, no. Like, the next word coming out of this person's mouth could be the gift I have been looking, could change my life. My experience is that when you show up listening that way, it does elevate people. They don't take up so much airtime. They don't ramble on so much. They're like, whoa, this group of people is taking me seriously. Like, I better stand and deliver here. And that those little gestures can bring that out of people. Now, I do want to say, there are going to be critics who say, oh, you're going to take seriously the things that others hold dear. You're going to listen to them like your most revered teacher, even if they're racist, sexist, homophobic, xenophobic, anti-Semitic. Like, go down the list. Why would you listen to those people? And I think there is a serious question about, do you listen to all people? Do you listen to all points of view, all times? Like, how do you handle that? I don't know if you want to talk about it, but I think it is an important question because I've had critics of Courageous Conversations say, yeah, but you're platforming the haters. Why would you do that?
Yeah, for me, I have maybe a different point of view on it, and that is maybe not, but a lot of criticism flowed to Joe Rogan for having Trump on. And I'm like, nope, that was a good thing. The bad thing was that the Democrats didn't go on. Now, did they have somebody who could go on? That's a different discussion again. Should he have given him a voice? I think he should. Bill Maher went to visit President Trump in the White House. Bill Maher got a lot of shit from that, saying he was played by Trump. Should he have gone? I think he should have gone. I think he should have had a conversation. I think there's also having a conversation and being informed and or not being informed. And that's not having a bias, but having information. What I mean by that is my opinion, not the truth. My opinion is that Bill Maher went there, came back and reported, and what he said got him a lot of criticism. He says he's not batshit crazy, he wasn't loony, blah, blah, blah. And the answer to that is, if you're psychologically informed, you will know, based on my assessment, I've never met Trump in person, but with my training, that this is a charismatic narcissist. And a charismatic narcissist will always play you, not because they're trying to play you, but because that's how they operate. They want you to like them. They want you to go away and say nice things about them. So, of course, you'll come away with a great guy. Without that information, you're going to read it as it is. And that's not wrong. It's just lack of the information. Should you give that person a voice? Yes. But should you also be informed about the play, what the game is? What was the name of that? See, I'm not a sports guy. Famous basketball player who went to play baseball.
Michael Jordan?
Michael Jordan. Thank you. He was fantastic at basketball and crap at baseball. He had in his head, I'm a sports person, I'll be great. Well, not so much. You need the information, the basic information, to do the thing well. And I think that that's sometimes what's missing. But that information, in many ways, to me, seems to be your five skills. Like, if I've got those five skills in place, maybe I can go in from a different place than maybe even Joe Rogan, who I think does a pretty good job of it, by the way, or Bill Maher, who was very courageous in going to confront Trump. I thought it was pretty great.
Yeah. Well, first, you put me in an awkward position that I have to defend Michael Jordan. I'm a Knicks fan. I don't like Michael Jordan or the Bulls, but he wasn't a terrible baseball player. He had potential.
I will take your word for it as a person who doesn't know shit about sports, fully owns.
I've taken the position that I'll talk to anyone, anywhere. That's been my posture. Now, that doesn't mean if I think it's physically unsafe, I will remove myself from the situation. So maybe at a Klan rally, I wouldn't try to meet with the Klan. That might not be that beneficial. When I say safe, I mean, there's a lot of talk about emotional safety. I don't mean that. I mean, like, if it's physically safe, I will talk to people who see things really differently. And I've talked to people who've said very difficult things to me about Jewish people in the Middle East, about all sorts of things that I care about and are part of who I am. I think there's a fundamental flaw with the idea that we won't talk to those people. Because those people aren't static. It's as if we could put a line down and say, all the people on that side of the line, we won't talk to them. I often will use the example that I think if you said, I'm not going to talk to the active anti-Semites in Germany in 1932, you could still talk to a lot of people. If you said by 1942, I'm not going to talk to the active anti-Semites, much smaller group of people for you to talk to because people move. And so I think it's really important not to draw the line that I will never talk to those folks. I also think it's important for one other reason, which is, and it goes back to where we started, it's easy to condemn those people. I'm not going to talk to the racist because I'm pure. I'm not going to talk to the sexist because I'm pure. And if we start from the other place that, like, whatever it is in them that's kind of on fire, there's a little seed of that in me too. I'm not morally pure and righteous, and they're fatally flawed. We all have the good and the bad inside of us. And so if you can remember that and believe that, even if you're expressing things that are fundamentally disagreeable to me, if they even threaten things about who I am and whether I would feel safe here, you're not just that. You're not defined by that. Brian Stevenson, who started the Legacy Museum in Montgomery and wrote the book, Just Mercy, he taught us that the people on death row are better than their worst deed. And I've taken that really seriously, and I've sort of extrapolated to say, well, and aren't our fellow Americans better than, quote, their worst vote? how can it be that because you had a bad vote, from my point of view, now you're irredeemable? No. You expressed yourself on that day in that way, but there's so much more to you and me. And I have bad days too, and I make choices that you may not like, but that doesn't mean you can look down on me or that I can look down on you. We still share so much more than divides us.
We're back to this idea of clinging that we put ourselves into. We cling to a thing, and it's really important to not cling to a thing, because we were talking about Rogan, and I'm trying to remember the name of the other comedians who have podcasts, and there's a couple of them, and I've watched them, and they openly say, I voted for Trump. And they're talking about the deportations that are happening with ICE. And they go, I didn't vote for this. People who did not vote for Trump are saying to me, well, this is what you voted for. And he goes, no, I didn't vote for this. And I remember a friend of mine asking me, who should I vote for? Should I vote for Hillary or should I vote for Trump? And I said, my only advice to you is don't vote against. And he goes, what do you mean? I go, if you vote against Hillary, because he thought she was really corrupt, if you vote against Hillary, then by nature of against, you got what you wanted, which is Trump. And you don't get to complain. If you vote against Trump and you vote for Hillary because you don't like what Trump is, then you don't get to complain when she's just doing the same old Democratic bullshit. You just don't. The thing is that this whole idea of democracy and voting is that the most patriotic thing you can do is to criticize your country because you want to make it better. Rather than getting rigid that we often do and we got to be right, where can we come together? As we go into that, I want to come to that second piece you said you wanted to go into, which is the storytelling. Because oftentimes it's the stories we tell ourselves that are so bloody destructive.
Yeah, I think maybe it's the complement to the listening skills. And so if you start with this idea that I'm going to listen with curiosity, I'm going to ask open-ended questions, I'm going to not take over the story when you're telling me a story, but I'm going to listen attentively, like you are my greatest teacher, just for this little bit of time. The counter to that is, or the flip side is, that I'm going to share stories. So often what people share, especially intense conversations when they disagree, is facts and opinions, not stories. Facts and opinions like kind of happen up here. Stories happen in a time and a place. And if I tell you a story about why this issue matters so much to me, how I came to see it this way, it may really open up nuance. I've had many people who are, let's say, anti-abortion or who are pro-death penalty. When you ask them for a story that informs how they see this, they'll often tell you a surprising story that seems to make the other point. Like, look, I'm pro-life, but I've got to tell you about this person I know and this thing happened to her. And in that case, I'm hard-pressed to say she should have to keep that unborn child. But my morality tells me this is the right answer. But sometimes you don't just get right and wrong. You get like right and right or wrong and wrong. And I have to grapple with that. Or someone who will talk about why they're against the death penalty. And then they'll talk about a tragic killing and how badly they would want to see sort of the scales of justice balanced. And so when people tell those stories on those hot topics, it's much harder to fight with them about it. Is there anti-Semitism on college campuses today? Well, we could fight and give opinions and statistics. If I tell you a story about what I heard about what happened to this kid on this college campus, that's not evidence that it's everywhere. It's a fact that it happened to this kid, and you want to take that seriously. So I try to encourage people. Often people think I'm going to take up too much time if I tell a whole story. But the fact is, like a well-told story, it can be 30 seconds, it can be 90 seconds, will open up so much more room for conversation than a quick opinion. I never think this. That's not possible. Here's the facts. It happened this way. That's the only explanation. Those kind of like summary headlines, they're kind of conversation closers, where a story is a conversation opener. And so I urge people, okay, you've done a good job listening. They've shared about themselves and how they've come to see it. Now, instead of looking for a line to expose their contradictions or something, tell a story about why this is so important to you, how you've come to understand it the way you have, why this is your priority, and then see where that leads you. Because that kind of listening balanced with storytelling maybe would be the essence of how I think we have these courageous conversations that could seem impossible. But when you do those simple things, they can kind of unfold themselves.
What's a story that transformed you? Well, transformed an idea that you held?
Yeah. So I have a friend who lives in the rural Midwest, and he used to tell me about how when he was young, in high school at public school in this rural community, they would drive to school in their car and park in the parking lot with their rifle in the back seat of the car. And at lunchtime, the teachers would come out and together they would sight the shotgun. And then when school ended, they'd go deer hunting. And he said, you know, in my wildest dreams, I never could have imagined taking that rifle into school and shooting up my classroom because I was unhappy about it. But decades later, my daughter goes to school in the same school district. There are no rifles in the back of cars in the parking lot and no teachers sighting the rifles at lunch. But they have mass shooter drills and his daughter has panic attacks about guns. And he said they took away the guns, but they didn't solve the problem of mass shooting events. And I grew up as someone who was very anti-gun. Like I grew up in New York City. The bad guys had guns, not the good guys. And so I'm not a Second Amendment person. And when he told me that story, I thought, I'm not sure people should still have guns and automatic weapons and all that, but I've got to take seriously that this is a person who gave an example of gun ownership mattering, it being part of his culture, and that when there were guns, there was no threat of violence in the school. Now there are no guns and there is a threat of violence in the school. So it can't be quite as simple as just take away the guns. There's something else that's changed in our culture that we should take seriously and attend to. And I think it's a good example for me of an issue where I had a very narrow definition of problem solution. And he exposed through his story that it's more complicated than meets the eye, or that it may seem like from a distance. When you get up close, there's more to it here. And maybe we need gun control, but maybe we also need to attend to a culture where violence has permeated every facet of our lives, and that we need to address that and mental health and how we manage access to weapons. And that's different than how I used to.
And in many ways, we have to examine even the kinds of conversations we're having that are catalyzing that kinds of violence, for instance, like I talked about right at the introduction to the show. We can't say suicide. We have to say unalived. The censorship is insane to me. And yet I can talk about things that make the other team just evil. And it's like, we have certainly lost our way of understanding the national narrative, of understanding and having compassion. This is one of the things I do love about your work. I'm just writing a piece for LinkedIn right now, where we talk about how we've become so fixated on empathy. And I believe that that's a failing, because empathy is passive. Compassion is active. Compassion is empathy plus action. And we need that rather than just, you just need to empathize with these people. No, you don't. Let's find the action where we can come together. And I feel like so much of what you do is about taking the empathy to compassion, taking it to action, where I can not just have you see it my way, but how can I see it your way? And what is the action we can take to mutually respect that? And I love that about your work. Thank you so much for not only being with us today, but for the work you do. I told you this last time. I am honored to have the conversation with you. I am delighted at the work that you're doing. I think it makes a significant difference in the world. And we have to let more people know about it. So in order to let more people know about it, they got to know how to find you. How do they do that?
Best way to find me is on LinkedIn. I'm right there. I'm easy to find. Just Simon Greer. Look me up. Happy to continue the conversation with anyone who's interested.
Do you have a podcast too? No. Okay. We'll make sure that people are sent to LinkedIn to find that out, and they'll be able to find you there. And of course, we'll make sure that the links are posted. Again, thank you for being with us. And for you, dear listener, remember, those who control the meaning for the tribe control the movement of the tribe. Leaders who are committed to positively shaping the political and business landscape know that they must tap into what drives human behavior. I am Dov Barron. I show businesses, teams, and leaders how to harness their emotional source code to move their tribe. Because unified, actualized meaning is the single monolithic difference between mediocrity and greatness for all individuals and companies. Remember, we need your help in staying relevant. So please go to wherever it is you tune in from and do us a favor. Rate, review, and subscribe to the show, because it makes a huge difference. And of course, a big thank you to you for sharing the show with everybody you know. We really do appreciate it. Till next time, stay curious, my friends. Stay curious about how you can have courageous conversations. Maybe courageous conversations is an understatement. Conversations that you think are impossible. How could you have that with somebody who you maybe think could never find a way to have any level of common ground? And what if that person is your greatest teacher. As we say in Jungian psychology, there's nothing you see in anyone else that doesn't exist in you. I'm Dov Barron. I'm here to assist you tapping into your deepest meaning to reach that next level of clarity, focus, purpose, and profit in your business, in your life, and your leadership impact. And I am out.